This is The Real Story from the BBC. I'm Rithula Shah with your weekly deep dive into a story that's making news and changing lives. And this weekend, history in the skies as, for the first time, a private company and not a space agency will attempt to put astronauts into orbit.
NASA is not going to purchase, own and operate the hardware. We are partnering with commercial industry with the intent that they would go get customers that are not NASA and drive down our costs and increase the access to space.
It's hoped the first manned flight of the SpaceX Crew Dragon capsule to the International Space Station will mark a return for America's ability to launch humans into space and jumpstart a whole new industry in near-Earth orbit. Privately owned space stations and hotels, permanent bases on the moon, and even the mining of asteroids for precious metals, they're all on the wish list for the handful of tech titans leading the charge. SpaceX owner Elon Musk says he wants to inspire the world.
Get the kids fired up about wanting to wear that spacesuit, wanting to go to orbit, go to the moon, go to Mars, reigniting the dream of space. I think anyone who has within them the spirit of exploration should love what's going on today.
But a billionaire's the best choice to lead humanity's push into this bold new era. Private capital can bear the costs and drive innovation, but who decides what can and can't be built on the moon? Where are the profits in the skies, and who'll be the first to exploit them? Will old-school international rivalries eventually clash with corporate cash? When it comes to the space race, a private company's lining up to lead the race and judge the winners. So, money, space, imagination, innovation, danger, and a certain amount of bitter rivalry. There's a rather intoxicating whiff from the ingredients of this week's Real Story. Inhaling the aroma, and I hope helping us to understand the complexities, are Charles Bolden, former astronaut and NASA administrator from 2009 to 2017. He's now a consultant for Axiom Space, which is planning to build the replacement to the International Space Station. Charlie Bolden, you've lived the childhood dream and gone into space. Can you remember what first inspired you?
Oh, I can remember very well. I was not one who grew up wanting to go to space. In fact, I was a very, very, very late bloomer. I was a test pilot at a place called Patuxent River, Maryland, enjoying life and flying airplanes. And I had an opportunity to meet a gentleman that I call the late, great Dr. Ron McNair. Ron was, like me, an African-American. He grew up about 42 miles from me, and I did not know him. But he had applied and been selected in NASA's first space shuttle class. And we talked for an entire weekend, and by the time he left, he shamed me into applying for the space program. When he asked me if I was going to apply, I told him, not on your life, and he asked me why not. I said, they never picked me, and he said, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. How do you know if you don't apply? And so I was embarrassed, and I got my pen and pad out and applied, and the rest is history.
Some fantastic mentorship there. Dr. Jill Stewart is from the London School of Economics and Political Science. She's an expert in the politics, ethics and law of outer space exploration and exploitation. Dr. Stewart, when did you first get the space bug?
You know, I loved hearing that story from Charlie. People ask me a lot if I always was interested in space from a young age. I wasn't. I came at it actually from the politics and legal perspective when I was an undergraduate student. I was asked to write a paper on international law, and I came across a book about outer space law. And I'm kind of embarrassed to admit, because I'm now one of the world's experts on outer space law, but at the time, I didn't know outer space law existed. And I saw this book and I thought, oh my gosh, we have thought about how to govern celestial territory, how to govern orbital slots, how to think ethically about potential colonization in the future. It hadn't even occurred to me 20 years ago when I was 20 years old. And that's when I got into space activity.
I hope we'll tap into some of that expertise in the next hour. Ariel Ekblor is the founder and lead of the MIT Media Lab's Space Exploration Initiative. She works with dozens of private sector companies producing prototypes for new technologies to be deployed in space. Was there a moment that inspired you, Ariel Ekblor?
I'm afraid I must admit I was one of those ones that has been captured by the cosmos very much since an early age. My path to it was really science fiction. My parents were both Air Force pilots, and my mom was actually one of the first female pilots in the country. And that led them to introduce my brother and I at a very young age to visions of the stars and fantastic books and storytelling. So from Robert Heinlein to Isaac Asimov and some you know, modern stories like Neal Stephenson's Seven Eves have really captured our imagination. And much of that love of science fiction is what inspires our work now at MIT, trying to make rigorously science fiction real and build out these prototypes of our future life in space.
That's a lovely story. John Logsdon is on the board of directors of the Planetary Society and is Professor Emeritus of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University. Welcome to you, Professor Logsdon. When did space grab your imagination?
I can tell you the day. I'm old, as that's what the emeritus in my title says. I'm old enough to have remembered Sputnik, but I don't. I'm old enough to have remembered John Kennedy's challenge to go to the moon, but I don't. But on March the 1st, 1962, I was working in Manhattan, New York City, and left to watch John Glenn parade through the city after his first flight. And I knew I was going back to graduate school that fall. I said, what is this space stuff all about? Ended up writing all my graduate papers on space topics and wrote a dissertation that turned into a book called The Decision to Go to the Moon. That led me to be at the launch of Apollo 11. And, you know, the rest, as Charlie said, is history.
Fantastic. Well, there is something rather wholesome, innocent almost, in our fascination with space. It's a place where science and human ingenuity are on full display. And yet our efforts to reach into the skies have been driven in the past by fierce Cold War rivalries. But the innovation and endeavour in the US in particular has long involved more than just government backing. Not that you necessarily realise that from some of the iconic science fiction that's shaped our view of space. In the world of the CBS Star Trek shows, corporations play no role in humanity's journey to the final frontier.
A lot has changed in the past 300 years. People are no longer obsessed with the accumulation of things. We have eliminated hunger, want, the need for possessions.
But then there's the far more dystopian 20th Century Studios portrayal of the Weyland-Yutani Corporation in the Alien film franchise, a company which at every step is willing to sacrifice people for profits.
I say we take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
Oh, hold on, 1 second. This installation has a substantial dollar value attached to it.
They can bill me.
3, 2, 1, 0. Ignition.
Liftoff.
Liftoff.
All right, liftoff, and the clock is starting.
But in reality, the private sector has been a big part of the space industry since the early days of the space race, at least on the US side. The Project Mercury space capsule, launching here in 1961, was actually constructed by the McDonnell Aircraft Corporation. The Apollo missions, too, relied heavily on private contractors. When Apollo 13's command module was crippled by an explosion on the way to the moon 50 years ago, the three-man crew only made it back by using the tiny lunar module as a lifeboat. It was designed for the short two-man journey down to the moon's surface and back and didn't have the power reserves needed to operate crucial systems for the long trip back to Earth. So NASA turned to the Grumman Aerospace Corporation for help. The reason? They were the ones who actually built it. Grumman engineer John Devaney earlier this year told Kevin Fong about how their expertise helped save the day.
They had these mission rules that were in their manuals. Now, in there were all kinds of really limits, red limits that you couldn't exceed. They were red lines. And we had to tell them, change all those red lines. You have to shut this off. You have to shut it off.
You, as the contractor who's built the lunar module, is being approached by the flight controllers who are saying, look, your instruction manual says we can't do these things. And you're turning around saying, forget that. We wrote that book. You can do it.
Exactly.
How heated do these discussions get between you and the
flight controllers? Very, very, very heated. Because you got to remember, they didn't have all the off-nominal testing that we had. We had all these testings that almost to the destruction on some of the equipment.
That's John Devaney speaking on the BBC World Service podcast 13 Minutes to the Moon. And there's a whole episode in season one of 13 Minutes exploring the role of the Apollo guidance computer in making all those missions possible. It was designed, of course, by Ariel's predecessors there at MIT. Ariel, do you think people realise how long private sector involvement has been there in the space programme?
That's a fantastic question. And I think depending on the communities that you come from, it is either more apparent or less. Certainly at MIT, we have this fantastic long tradition of working so closely with Draper Labs, which had this incredible role in the, providing the guidance systems, the Apollo computer that was able to provide that navigation to get to the moon. And there's a fantastic, even longer history of astronomy being promoted by benefactors, you know, all the way back to the Carnegies and before. And so in some ways, there is a long tradition of this support from industry and from private capital. In the way that we see it, while I am one of those, you know, Star Trek fans, and I hear Jean-Luc Picard in that voiceover at the beginning of the clip, and I think to myself, yes, you know, he is envisioning this future without a reliance on commercial activity. But for us, the commercial partners that we work with have been not exploitative, but enabling. They are the ones that are helping us get access in really innovative ways for an upstart academic group to explore the future of space and get our payloads out there.
So thinking about how the industry works now, John Logsdon, is there a difference between companies, say, wanting to launch satellites, have space travel, and the kind of research-facing work that someone like NASA has always done?
Well, I mean, companies often do not investigate far-out technologies where there was no clear market potential. And that's really the role of government, is to invest in technologies that the private sector would not invest in. It's a kind of market failure argument. That's not the way it's worked, since government until recently was, for most areas of space activity, the only customer. What's different now is that the private sector sees a market, sees profit potential in selling other than to government, and is willing to make the investments and create the capabilities and take the market risks to bring new services, new products to market.
So describe the kind of work that private companies are doing now.
Well, it ranges from the most far out kind of ideas, like space elevators is the one that pops right to mind. There is a foundation called the Breakthrough Foundation that wants to send a tiny spacecraft to the nearest star. So, you know, that kind of very cutting edge stuff, to developing, in SpaceX's case, the ability to reuse the rocket, something that the public sector never did, because it lowers costs, allows them to make more money.
So, Ariel, in your day job, what's the sort of the craziest thing that you're dreaming up, in a sense, that could be done by the private sector?
Well, our mission is to think about how we both democratize access to space and how we design the artifacts for a life in space that would not just answer the survivalist mentality that we've had for so long, but now standing on the shoulders of giants like Charlie Bolden and the work at NASA, we're able to think about the types of products, tools, and human experiences that would really delight humans for that life in space. So everything from self-assembling space architecture, imagine Legos that are floating peacefully in a space orbit and snap themselves together to form a space station, saving an astronaut from having to do what we call an EVA or an extravehicular activity, to musical instruments that are designed to only be able to be played in microgravity and give us this opportunity to, rather than always importing elements of culture from Earth and just assuming that that's where we'll have all of our innovation from space, actually begin to build a native space culture and explore what that can mean. And by democratizing access to space, we bring in many different fields and disciplines in that work, from artists to scientists and engineers.
I mean, that all sounds rather dreamy and wonderful, but there is sort of more obvious stuff, isn't there? Like startups which are designing sort of low Earth orbit adverts that we'll be able to see in the sky, which, you know, it's going to change the look of the night sky potentially.
Indeed. Yeah, there are startups looking at the future of on-demand meteor showers, advertisements in space. I think many of us have strong feelings about how would we approach the commercialization of low Earth orbit such that it can still be protected and respected as a commons, but open to commercial innovation. And as John was saying, a fantastic role for NASA in the future. It's really not an either-or question. It's not a commercialization or NASA or space agencies. But NASA can continue to do what Charlie Bolden and David Newman did so beautifully, which was give us that aspirational next step goal of pushing out to Mars, as we become more comfortable with low Earth orbit, NASA can continue to provide that next milestone that humanity will reach for.
Charlie Bolden, is that how you see NASA developing? Is that the kind of role you imagine it taking on?
I think that's its role exactly. You know, one of the reasons I think that we had such a difficult time in retiring the shuttle and moving on to commercial space is because many people who had been in the space shuttle program or in the space program period had really fallen in love with being the operators. It was easy to come to work every day and launch people and save them on orbit and everything else. But we forgot that we were a research and development organization and not an operational organization.
You're now a consultant for a company called Axiom Space, which is looking at the future of the International Space Station. How is that evolving?
It's evolving very well. And you know, interestingly, the founder of Axiom Space and now its president and CEO is a guy named Mike Suffredini, who during much of my time as the NASA administrator, actually was the program manager for the International Space Station. And inside NASA, we talked all the time about the future. How do we get ourselves out of station, because it's a machine that's gonna run out of life soon? And do we want to build another one, or should we move on and commercialize low Earth orbit? And Mike was one who, you know, like me, really believed that that was where we should be working for the future. Particularly if I'm a Mars guy, so I want to go to Mars. It was obvious to me that we were not going to get to Mars if NASA was stuck in low Earth orbit, because you only have finite funds. And that meant we had to have commercial space stations. And that's what Axiom's trying to do.
But some might look at the International Space Station and say this was something that's really defined international cooperation, the Russians and Americans particularly, working together. In the future,
it didn't start that way. And John Logsdon, I call him the dean of space history. That was not the plan. When the space station started, nobody thought that we were going to have Russia and the United States as the principal partners. That evolved when the wall came apart.
But in the future, if you have lots of private companies, and it's quite US-centric in a sense, this conversation, lots of private companies jostling, competing, you know, to be the first to get their innovations forward, could you imagine that kind of work being done collaboratively in a space like the International Space Station?
Yeah, and one of the reasons it's so difficult is because, and I'm speaking out of school here, I'm not an expert in this. One of our most difficult things was helping other countries understand the concept of commercialism. Nobody does it the way we do it in the United States, unfortunately. And so, you know, when we talk about commercial things, it's obvious to us we're talking about making money and commerce. And since many other of our partner nations are highly subsidized by government, that's a foreign concept to them.
John Logsdon, how do you see this working then?
Well, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that this is a U.S.-centric conversation, and that's precisely for what Charlie just said. The United States is a decade or two anyway ahead of the rest of the world in the engagement of its private sector in space activities. Commercializing human spaceflight, the glamorous aspects of being in space, is kind of an American innovation. It reflects our value system and the way we've gone about space, and maybe even the reason why the United States is in space. One reason has always been economic payoffs, economic competitiveness. So the rest of the world is seeing this happen, and I think is slowly coming to join the U.S., but certainly this country, since the Reagan administration in the 80s, has put a lot of attention to the commercial opportunities that exist in space.
Jill Stewart.
Could I come in on that? And actually, I'd be really curious what John thinks. I completely agree. Like, the whole narrative around commercialization and capitalism was very much part of the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union, which fueled the first space age. But my understanding is that actually, for example, the Soviet Union or Russia, after the fall of the Soviet Union, was actually quite key in commercializing the International Space Station in terms of bringing private tourists up from, I think, 2001. And that, for example, China was using privately commissioned satellites from like the 1980s. So, yes, I know that it was also key in the United States under Reagan. But I think a lot of countries have been following a similar path of both putting government money into space activity, but also the commercial industry following on kind of inevitably because there's money to be made there.
So if you though bring it back to where we are now and the companies that are in the field now, if you look at, I don't know, SpaceX, Blue Origin, is there a danger, Jill Stewart, that they in a sense are so far ahead that they have the intellectual property, the trademarks and so on, that they create an environment which is their own? You know, they've built it, they inhabit it, and they will decide who else gets to come in.
No, not at all. That's kind of what I'm saying is I think I sometimes say that it's an evolution rather than a revolution, the commercialization of space. You know, these companies have been around for a long time. The legal infrastructure which guides what they are allowed to do has been around for a long time.
But can you imagine a Chinese company or an Indian company actually ever catching up with SpaceX when it comes to the sort of capabilities it's already built up?
That's a good question. Good question. Go ahead.
Now, I was just saying, I don't think in today's China, you know, the People's Liberation Army is going to allow a company that kind of freedom. When we started working with China in aeronautics, we were brought in to help them with the flow of air traffic. We were trying to sign an agreement. We worked on it for more than a year. I went over to sign only to find that we had never talked to anybody in the PLA, and they're the ones that control the airspace. So it's going to be hard for a commercial company, truly commercial company, to do what a SpaceX has done.
John Logsdon, and if not a company, then even perhaps the Chinese government and the sort of technology entities it might have created.
Well, I mean, after all, China has a different form of economic organization, so the comparisons are a little tricky. But there is an entrepreneurial sector emerging in China. In space, I think China is maybe 20 or 30 years behind in its evolution to Western countries, particularly the United States. But in 2050, I expect there'll be an active Chinese quasi-private sector. SpaceX has emerged very quickly because of the character of Elon Musk and his driving the company to go fast. By contrast, Blue Origin, its motto is to go slowly and ferociously. So it's developing capabilities that at some point will be different but equally impressive to SpaceX. It's each country and each company has its own profile.
Ariel Ekblor?
Thanks. Yeah, I wanted to comment here about the question of, as we see these leading companies racing ahead, just a couple of them, is there that risk of monopoly or intellectual property capture? And my argument would be, first, that we're seeing, thankfully, a proliferation of activity in this area. There are many, many different actors and stakeholders that are interested in lunar activity in particular. And so I think that that diversity will keep it to be a bit of a healthier ecosystem. But from a technical side, I just wanted to have the listeners hear a little bit about the incentive for different companies to be able to interoperate in orbit and on the surface of the moon for safety. So there's a long tradition of being able to think about standards that allow you to, say, rescue a fellow astronaut or dock between two different types of spacecraft. And I would see that likely continuing. So even if we do say, you know, see SpaceX and Blue Origin being the first to establish really sustainable settlement on the lunar surface, if they were so fortunate, there would still be plenty of incentives for them to be able to work together on common infrastructure like landing pads, water extraction, and other infrastructure like that. And in that realm, in that spirit, one of the projects that we're excited to be working on at MIT is something of a lunar open architecture to look at how we can provide open access information sharing for the future of space technology development, so that we can have essentially an active dynamic roadmap where other actors can see where are the hotspots and where are the missing gaps in technology development and have a collaborative approach to that future exploration.
Jill Stewart, for that to work, it seems like a very noble way to go forward. For that to work, does there need to be some kind of regulatory infrastructure? Are there treaties that govern space?
Oh, this gets really complicated and interesting, but in very short, there are five main treaties that govern outer space that were set up in the 1960s and 1970s through the United Nations. And the most important one was the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, as we call it for short, and it says that no country may lay claim to outer space territory. And then subsequent treaties sort of established liability. So if objects crash into each other, you have to pay for it. If astronauts crash, they carry their nationality, you have to be nice to them and send them home and that sort of thing. So four out of the five have been widely ratified by all of the world's countries. The fifth one had to do with mining the moon, which is a whole other topic that we could probably spend a lot of time talking about. It's the only one that hasn't been ratified by many countries, so it's considered a non-starter. But the other four, which have to do with ownership and liability and astronauts, are very accepted within the global community as being authoritative. And yeah, what they say is that outer space is neutral territory. What's tricky about it is that because they were written in the 60s and 70s at the start of the space age and modeled upon the high seas treaties, they are very focused on countries. And so they say, you know, no country can claim authority over outer space. And now we're talking about companies, or companies and countries in conglomeration with each other. And so legally, it starts getting really complicated.
I'm also intrigued by your reference to the moon, because if, from what we've been hearing now, there is a profit motive, companies are going to want to make money out there, then isn't mining the moon an obvious way in which somebody might choose to dig out the minerals and bring them back to Earth? If you don't have an agreement on something like that, isn't there potential for lots of conflict not very far down the path?
For those of us in outer space law, this is a really hot topic right now. The idea of mining celestial territory and specifically the moon. The thing is, I think it would be less likely that we'd bring resources back to the Earth, but you would use them in situ. But yeah, whether or not you can extract resources and use them is something that is subject to a lot of legal discussions at the moment.
Well, come on, who'd like to put my mind at rest on that one?
I mean, you know, the U.S. Congress was so bold as to pass, and the president signed into law, was it last year or a year before, Jill? You know, a law that said any company, meaning any U.S. company, that was able to get to an asteroid or the moon and take material, it belonged to them. That is contrary to what is generally accepted space law, as I understand
it. That was the Commercial Space Act of 2017, as I understand it. What's interesting is, again, as I understand it, at the last minute, they added a clause saying, so long as these companies are staying in line with our international obligations, which would put the legislation itself in contradiction to the international obligations that the U.S. has.
John Logsdon, does this confusing. Worry you? Is it the sort of thing that that should be keeping us awake at night?
Well, Jill's a good example. Lawyers can argue forever about anything. you know, and they have been with regard to property rights, outer space property rights. What's going to happen is at some point in the future, some private company is going to go and do this and say, now we've shown it can be done, establish, in fact, what the rules are. You know, the law is going to be established by reaction to activity. First, we got to get back to the moon and find out whether there are any valuable resources actually there. There are a lot of people who think they're there, particularly frozen water in the craters at the poles of the moon. But we haven't really explored the moon for the last humans left the moon in 1972. So I think one of the reasons for going back is to finish the exploration so that we know what's there to be exploited.
Do you think that a corporate structure, if you like, the way in which the corporate structure is becoming part and parcel of space, John Logsdon, actually waters down potentially the geopolitical rivalry that existed in the past and may again exist in the future if there is valuable stuff on the moon?
Well, I think if it's the private sector that's doing it is in the lead role, the link to national rivalries can be ameliorated, minimized a bit, but government industry partnerships as one of the trends for the future of space. And so I think there's still going to be an underlying government interest as this new frontier gets further explored and further developed that will connect to 21st century rivalries.
Okay, well, let's think about, we've talked about how companies are driving the kind of exploration we're doing and the kind of issues that may or may not arise. But what about some of the individuals who are now leading this race, determining its direction? Elon Musk, the founder of PayPal, the person pushing Tesla, and also now SpaceX. He's a larger-than-life character with larger-than-life aspirations. The inspiration for Tony Stark in the Iron Man films. But he's also quite prickly and controversial. Jeffrey Sonnenfeld is the Senior Associate Dean of Leadership Programs and a professor in the practice of management at Yale University. He told me he's not convinced that Elon Musk is an ideal standard bearer for humanity's push out into the cosmos.
He is a visionary, the classic entrepreneur, in terms of being a leader for the next stage of life for this enterprise. It's highly unlikely. It's like a ticking time bomb. The world is different because he's lived. Like Nikola Tesla himself, Musk is a mercurial person. And you just worry. You know, Sigmund Freud once said that society is changed by its discontents. People like him and Mark Zuckerberg, of course, of Facebook, or the late Steve Jobs of Apple, they're not the easiest people to be with, but the world is better because they're around, but it doesn't mean you hand over the keys.
Why is it so important that we understand that a company doing this kind of work is well run? I suppose the comparison with somewhere like NASA, which has been developed over decades, is we know an awful lot about it, whereas any private company is going to be necessarily less transparent.
The transparency is important because there are human lives at stake and the degree of international cooperation that's involved. When he is told that because of public health issues, there was going to be a slight delay in opening up his Fremont factory in California, that he went into a childish temper tantrum and a Trump-like tweet storm calling people fascist and all the rest. Certainly, he gets attention. He breaks through the clutter, and then people try to calm him down, the crazy like a fox, perhaps parallel. There are limits to that. And again, he's losing buckets of money, even at Tesla, even with the volume of production. How long can that last? I don't know.
The views of Professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld from the Yale School of Management. Ariel, you've worked with SpaceX. Is there a vision without Elon Musk?
I think this is a fantastic moment to call out a really admirable and leading woman in the space industry, whose name is Gwynne Shotwell, someone who many of us in the industry look to as a leading force for the organization and the competence of SpaceX. I think she's doing a fantastic job there as president, helping move that organization forward and letting it still answer the impressive vision of Elon Musk. And as Jeremy called out, it does help to have visionaries like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk at the helm. But having Gwynne Shotwell there to be able to give the operations focus for SpaceX, for them being able to deliver on launches and the future of Crew Dragon, for example, which we're all, of course, very much looking forward to the second launch attempt on Saturday, something I would just love to have called out there.
I would strongly second that motion. Gwynne Shotwell is SpaceX.
So are we just attached to these erratic characters? Or when you were at NASA, were there those slightly kind of people with big ideas, a bit difficult to work with perhaps, but everybody kind of respected them? Is it something that we're just attracted to? Maybe not even the most important people in the place.
You know, going back to what Ariel said, while I was the NASA administrator, I met and talked to Elon now and then, but when it came to real business and getting things done, we worked with Gwynne as the president and COO of the company, and with Hans Kunenberg there. Well, Elon, I think, considers himself the chief engineer, but Hans Kunenberg is really the chief engineer. A superb leadership team. Elon is the charismatic guy that brings a lot of attention to it, but I guess enough said.
Is there a race then? Do you think there is a tension potentially between a company like SpaceX and NASA when it comes to the race to reach Mars?
No. Well, it's really today between Elon and Jeff Bezos, because they're the two companies that realistically have a shot at human vehicles that go into orbital spaceflight. And as John said, because of their slow but steady, ferociously mantra, Blue Origin hasn't quite gotten there yet, but they will.
And what would be the role of NASA in a project like that?
Leadership and organization. I'll defer to John, but and Ariel, because she works with a lot of these folk. NASA provides the vision.
Ariel, what do you think a Mars project might look like?
I can see, much in the way that Charlie's describing, NASA providing what we might say like the top level objectives. So guiding the science, guiding the decisions on how we think about leveraging the decades of research inside NASA for habitats, keeping astronauts safe, providing for the CONOPS or the concept of operations for the mission. And then groups like Blue Origin, who we also work very closely with, and SpaceX, providing the rockets to get us there, providing some of the operational support to be able to really stand up a sustainable, we hope, settlement on the surface of the moon or Mars. It's interesting now, of course, that we're pivoting back to look at the moon first, but as a milestone towards testing technology to get to Mars. But what I'd be really interested to see both of those companies achieve is progress in what we think of as three of the major gatekeeper technologies. So one of course, is propulsion, which we hear so much focus in both companies on the rockets to get us there. But then also in situ resource utilization, which needs quite a lot more focus to be able to really build up the ability to manufacture from materials or extracted resources once you're there on the planet or the celestial body. And then finally, for Mars, entry, descent, and landing technology, the ability to safely land a capsule, a crewed capsule, something we're still looking at from a technological standpoint.
So colonization, though, is the ultimate aim, and that's very much there, front and center.
Please don't use the word colonization. Settlement, if anything. Colonies are a many-century-ago phenomenon, and hopefully we're well behind it.
And what's the crucial difference? Is it the idea that it's a settlement that is, to go back to something that Ariel talked about before, this idea of it's democratized, it's open, as opposed to somebody arriving there first and claiming it as their own?
The use of the phrase colonization has a lot of baggage with it. I think that we don't want there to be any determinism, like a sense that we will have to do it the same way again. Like, this is a new slate. We can do things differently.
Well, returning to the mechanics of how it might be done, there is a partnership going on between the European Space Agency and NASA on the Orion vehicle to get to Mars. So is it likely that a Mars mission might be a US-European one? Or would it need to draw in Russia, China, say, to make it more affordable, more feasible?
I think it's going to be a partnership of the willing of those countries, and I believe it's going to be government-dominated at the start to the initial voyages to Mars, and it's going to be a partnership among those countries and their private sector companies that are interested in being part of that. It could be the U.S. and Europe. I mean, you've got a 15-nation partnership in the International Space Station, that sets a precedent for lots of countries working together on a challenging undertaking. So I think it is going to be a coalition that still needs to be built for deep space exploration, back to the moon and then journey to Mars. And that's going to be a challenge for governments in the coming years.
But that's the lofty stuff. More immediately, is there likely to be a public debate on whether we want, I don't know, a night sky full of space hotels and commercial satellites? Is that something we ought to be talking about now, Jill?
I absolutely think that the public should engage with this, and this is one of the reasons I talk publicly a lot. I think there's a sense that because it's inevitable that the technology is going to allow us to mine resources and go into space, that it's just going to happen, and therefore it's not worth having a conversation. I don't agree with that. I think we should have a conversation. What do we want? And I think one of the most important questions we have now is who is representing us in space? So this launch, which has now been postponed, but is kind of embodies this whole concept of when we look at space, it's sort of who we think represents us as a species. I think we should be able to talk about if we want that to be individual countries or companies. And at the end of the day, the money has to come from somewhere. So I am realistic, and I know that there's an industry behind this and it is going to be driven by money. But I think we can still have these conversations about who represents us as we potentially leave Earth.
I could not agree more. I think Jill phrases it really beautifully. It's so important for the public to be very much engaged. And the way that we try to, you know, begin to answer this is people say, wow, there's such a large domain of questions to answer. Do we have any framework here? And what we might point people to is the long tradition of techniques like urban planning on the surface of the earth, right? We have certain predicated ideas for how to handle waste and the proliferation of satellite debris, how to handle traffic, whether it's car traffic or the future satellite traffic, how to think about equity of access in communities. Now, of course, we're trying to do this more responsibly on the surface of the earth. Can we also think about equity of access to orbits, frequency bands for satellites, and begin to understand low Earth orbit, this beautiful near Earth cocoon, as a domain that we want to be thoughtful and intentional about in a sense of urban planning or low Earth orbit planning.
But do you feel optimistic that that's possible, given how we operate on Earth?
Oh, for this, I might defer back to John, the historian, the dean of space history, as Charlie Bolden called him, for a sense of perspective on how achievable it is. I think the more we talk about it, I think the more that people like Jill go out and share this call for us to be thinking about the ethics and the policy of space, I'm optimistic, but I am a glass half full kind of person. So maybe Jill and John want to jump in there.
My PhD was actually on looking at the degree to which people collaborate on activity in outer space governance. And I assumed as my starting point that people were basically really nasty. So why would people collaborate? And I found that there were reasons for countries and companies to actually collaborate on activity in outer space. So for example, if you look at orbits, if we all put stuff up and don't collaborate, then everybody gets destroyed, like the tragedy of the commons. So there are, even if you take a really negative view of humanity, there are reasons why in space there has been collaboration and possibly cooperation.
John, if I can bring you in and throw in one more thought. If you think about the nadir to which US-China relations have plunged in recent times, doesn't that give you more cause for concern then about how we keep cooperation going on in space, in the commons, as Jill described it?
You have to remember how intense the antagonism between the United States and the Soviet Union has been historically since the end of World War II, and yet we're working together on the International Space Station. We found in space an arena where we could cooperate. Charlie has, you know, had a lot of firsthand experience with that. It's a tense kind of touchy relationship, but it works. We have yet to forge the relationship with the other aspiring major space power, that is China. Our politicians in the United States have put a rule that says that NASA can't bilaterally work with China, and I think that's kind of stupid. We have to find a way of working together in this arena to avoid destructive conflict while still competing. So I'm guardedly optimistic that the international regime for space activities can evolve to accommodate the emerging private sector, can accommodate the earthbound rivalries between nations, and we can keep outer space a peaceful, sustainable arena. Now, that's very optimistic, but Charlie, after all, is a two-star general. Let him talk about this.
Absolutely, Charlie.
No, I'm like John. I'm guardedly optimistic. And I know we're nearing the end of the program, but I want to throw out something for a future program. We have not mentioned another very significant part of the world, and that's the Arab world. This July, the UAE, and Ariel may know more about this than I do, because MIT has been very active in supporting work in the UAE. A lot of their space program is, based around people who came out of MIT, but they will launch the Emirates Mars mission in July. And it will be the first time that an Arab nation has left Earth orbit to go somewhere. And if they're successful, and that's a big if, because getting to Mars is incredibly difficult for anybody. But if they're successful, they will be only the third nation in the world to put an operating orbiting satellite around Mars with a scientific purpose. It is led by women for the most part, which I find absolutely flabbergasting. So we need to have a conversation about the UAE and their leadership in the Arab world.
And just to really, in a sense, draw on your on the inside seat you may have had during some of those Russian-American tensions, I mean, what was the lesson you drew from that?
Oh, the lesson I drew, because my first experience was flying as a commander of the first joint Russian-American mission, STS-60, in 1994. And a couple of years earlier, when I was told that I was at NASA headquarters, I was told they wanted me to go back and command another shuttle mission. I said, shoot, put me in, coach. And then I said, what is it? Hoping that it would be the first Hubble Space Telescope repair mission. They said, no, that one's already gone to Dick Covey, but we want you to fly the first Russian cosmonaut. I said, forget it. I am a Marine pilot, and I have trained all my life to kill those guys and them to kill me. And I don't want to do anything with any damn Russians. And my boss said, calm down, go to dinner tonight. Two of them are in town. Talk to them and then let me know what you think in the morning. And that night I had dinner with Sergei Krikalev, with whom I ended up flying, Vladimir Titov, both veteran Russian cosmonauts. And we spent the evening talking about our families and our kids and what we wanted for the future and the world we saw we could do. And I went back in the next morning. I said, I'm in. And that was the beginning of a 2-year relationship in training and bringing their families to the U.S. and their back, you know, their support teams and everything. And that's what John's talking about. It's the personal interaction that overcomes the resistance of government. Our work with China and our work with UAE and other Arab nations is going to be led by industry because they're in there already. UAE is working with UC Boulder and Berkeley and Lockheed Martin and everybody while the government twiddles their thumbs. So the interpersonal relationships are being done at the industry and academic level while the government is brought along. Same thing happening with China right now. There's a company called NanoRacks that has actually flown Chinese experiments to the International Space Station over the objection of Congress, you know, but managed to get it done.
So in a sense, you're saying where there is friction on a political level, diplomatic level, actually space science is working in an altogether different way.
Exactly.
This was a long time ago. It might be out of date now, but I remember reading a study one time that if you looked at double-blind peer-reviewed research, which is the premier of research, articles about space have the most number of international authors, so authors from two different nationalities. Space research lends itself to people collaborating.
Well, that's a fantastic optimistic place at which to end this week's program. We began by talking about how the private sector is driving the dynamic of space exploration, and we've ended by talking about how it actually perhaps brings countries closer together than may appear from reading the news headlines and the political headlines. That is a great thought. Thank you very much to this week's panel, a journey that was really quite an unexpected one and took us to places I didn't necessarily expect to go in the best possible way. Thank you very much to Dr. Jill Stewart, Ariel Ekblor, Professor John Logsdon, and Charles Bolden. Thank you very much to you all. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our feed. Scroll back and you'll find last week's edition, in which we explore the level of risk we as individuals are and should be willing to accept as lockdowns across the planet are eased. How do we judge when it's once again safe enough to send kids back to school or to embrace an elderly relative? And if you'd like to get in touch to suggest future topics, you can find me on Twitter, @Rittler. For this week, that's it from me, Rithula Shah, and the whole team. That's The Real Story. Thank you for listening. Do join us again next time.